Are we all ready? Lights, cameras, action! Okay, this title of this night's talk is Living the Dhamma. Certainly because many of the talks I've given so far on other aspects of the Dhamma, this is actually how, not just expecting the monks to live the Dhamma, not just the BGX to do the Dhamma work for you, but why not you? In other words, we can live that Dhamma and we can actually explore that Dhamma. We can realize that Dhamma in little ways. And thereby, we become happier, more peaceful people in this world. This Dhamma which the Buddha taught, the sort of Dhamma I've been teaching today, what the BGX says, ancient wisdom, but modern presentation. Is that right? Can you turn around? What does it say again? No, turn around. Modern approach, thank you. Turn back again. That's excellent because this is actually how we live the Dhamma. This ancient wisdom, 2600 years old, in a state, in a country called India. It's so far away from places like Malaysia or Australia, both in kilometers and in time. But that Dhamma of the Buddha is so vibrant, is so powerful, and it's changing the world. Just this afternoon, we had a visiting monk here. He said something which was really quite amazing. He was recently in a conference, a Christian Buddhist conference in Germany, where he said the Bishop of Hamburg, the present Bishop of Hamburg, Anglican, told him that, as far as he was concerned, that Buddhism is the future religion of the world. And that's coming from a Christian. Now, why do they say that? Why is it that Buddhism is certainly the fastest growing religion in Australia? When I first went there, it's very hard to find a Buddhist. Now one in every 50 people in Australia is a Buddhist, 2% of the population. It's growing very, very fast. That's bad news for me. It means I really have to work even harder. But why is that many people deciding to actually to live Buddhism? The reason is because it's such a powerful teaching, it's a timeless teaching, which actually produces the goods. People these days will only follow a religion if it solves the problems of your life, if it's applicable to your daily life, if it's relevant. Also, just a few minutes ago, I was talking to a youth group, and I was telling them, look, if you want to get young people into Buddhism, then Buddhism should teach the young men how to chat up girls. It should teach the girls how to relate to their boyfriends. It should teach the students how to deal with learning at school. It should teach them about things which are relevant to them. Otherwise, why would young people come to listen to the Dhamma? And I mentioned some stories which saying that how Buddhism can enhance such social skills. Remember what I said the other day when I was a young man, when I was out to try and catch some girls? This was before I was a monk. And whenever you'd see a nice girl at a party or a dance, you'd plan what you were going to say, first of all. You'd rehearse it. And when you went up to speak to her, you got nervous. You made a mess of what you were going to say. And my goodness, you made a fool of yourself. And I did that many times before I learned how to relax and let go. To have that self-confidence so that you can go and approach someone and just be yourself. Straightforward Buddhist teachings, letting go, relaxing, being content, being in the moment, not being worried. Not only does it make you reach enlightenment, but also, all you young boys in this group, it makes you get better girlfriends. And as far as your girls are concerned, you become more mindful, more alert, so you don't get landed with second-rate boyfriends. No riffraff, only the best when you're mindful. So many parts of life can use Buddhist psychology, Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist wisdom to enhance your life. Sometimes people think that Buddhism may be okay in the monasteries, and I'm extending it now to young people. You could extend it to business as well. businesses who use Buddhist principles do extremely well. The Buddhist principles. Look, this was a talk which was given by an economist at one of the Buddhist conferences about 3 or 4 years ago. This particular economist, an advisor of the Bank of England, a professor, I think, at Reading University of Economics, is a long-standing Buddhist. He was an Englishman. And he was telling how Buddhism would enhance any economy. His particular thesis was, or his particular topic of this conference is, are Buddhist monks and nuns good for the economy? Because these days, governments and many other people measure what's useful or not useful by its effect on the economy. He said, monks or nuns, they don't produce material goods. They don't add, as it were, to the tangible national product. But the effect of Buddhist monks and nuns in a community is to increase people's honesty and trust. He said there's something in economy, in all economics, called transaction costs. It's because the supplier cannot really trust sort of their client. They don't know whether their client is going to pay for those goods you supply them. And the client, the customer, cannot trust the supplier whether the goods they order are actually what they want. And because of that lack of trust, sometimes it seems called transaction costs, insurance and other such things. And as an economist, he was saying transaction costs, they cut a large amount from a company's profits simply because we can't trust one another. He said, Buddhist monks enhance, encourage, and generate greater trust in any community. He said, just for that, Buddhist monks have an extremely positive effect on any country's economy. Have you seen how the Australian economy is doing so well in recent years? That's because of monks like me. I don't know if that's true, but that's just what I'm saying. So you can actually see that in all aspects of life, these Buddhist principles work. But what are those Buddhist principles? You see, in a nutshell, I've given many, many talks about Buddhist principles. The one I'm going to focus on today is mindfulness and compassion. Basic, traditional, ancient Buddhist principles, but presented in a modern way. There's one of the stories, which are one of the key stories, not of my talks, but of my life. What I talk and what I say to you is how I practice my own life. This is a story of the Emperor's Three Questions. It never came from any Buddhist text. You can't see this in the Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Pure Land schools. But my goodness, it does cut to the heart of the Buddha's teachings. That's why when I first read this, it inspired me. And it was one of the ways that I present Buddhism to modern audiences. It's a story which was told by, actually, Leo Tolstoy himself. It was in a book of Russian folk tales which I picked up from the library as a student at Cambridge. The story was of an emperor a long time ago who, like many modern people, did not like modern religion. He said that all these religions, they were just rooted in the past, they didn't really make sense to the modern times, they weren't relevant, they were just like dinosaurs from a past age. He wanted to find a religion which worked for him, which he could apply to his job, his role in life as an emperor, and which also could satisfy his spiritual leanings. It's just the same way that each one of us, we want a religion. If we are Buddhists, we want Buddhism to help us in our daily life, as a businessman, as a student, as a wife, as a child. We want Buddhism to be relevant to us, but also we don't want it just to help us live our life in a more successful way. We want it to be meaningful to the truth inside our hearts, to our spiritual dimension. And that was the same as this emperor in the story. He rejected orthodox religions. He wanted to find his own way through religion and through life. After much discussion, going to talks, investigating, reading and pondering, he decided if he could just get the answer to three major questions of life, that would give him all the religion, the philosophy he ever needed. It became the emperor's three questions. First question being, when is the most important time? Second question, who is the most important person? Third question, what is the most important thing to do? It was the when, the who, and the what of life. Altogether, it becomes the why. The why not you of this talk, or the why of this whole series of talks. It was the when, the who, the what questions. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? And after a long search, which took up most of the story, he found those answers. When is the most important time? Who knows when the most important time is? What is the most important time? Now. So why do you waste so many nows racing after something in the future which never comes? We say that. Everyone says that answer, that now is the most important time. But how many of you actually practice that? If you've got a mother or a father, you young people, who you really respect, have you told them today how much they mean to you, how much they love you, how much you love them, and how much gratitude you have for your mother or your father? Don't wait until tomorrow. Tomorrow never comes. The opportunity doesn't come again. It's why you have to say it now. Husbands and wives, have you said today how much you love your partner? How much they mean to you? How much you care for them? If you don't say that now, the moment never comes. Women don't feel appreciated. Husbands don't feel understood. There's no communication, because we leave off saying these important things till another day. Don't leave off sending the Valentine's card till February the 14th. Send it today. Who cares what day it is? Now is the most important time. Also, when you've made a mistake and you want to say sorry, ask for sorry now. Tomorrow might be too late. I know this from my own experience, bitter experience. When I was growing up in London, I loved music. My favourite music was Jimi Hendrix, you might be surprised to know. It was very loud. When my father wanted to play his music, which was Frank Sinatra, just because I was rebellious, I played my Jimi Hendrix. My Jimi Hendrix music was much louder than his Frank Sinatra. I drowned him out. I was just being a silly 14 or 15 year old. My father was very loving and tolerant. But soon after that, my father died when I was only 16. I remember after he died, one of my feelings was how guilty I felt. I'd hurt my dad, who I loved. Just silly things. There's many things which I did I wanted to say sorry for, and now my father wasn't there anymore. I could not say how much I loved him and cared for him and how grateful I was for all his teachings. I've already told many of you, it was from my dad, my father, I got the meaning of love. The door of my heart will always be open to you no matter what you do. That was my father's teaching to me. You know, just to go off on a tangent, my own father was born in Liverpool. Before the Second World War, that was a very, very poor city. He called his father, my paternal grandfather, He called him a, please excuse me, but I have to say this, he called him a bastard. He said because he would come home drunk every night. Every night. He would take off his belt for no reason at all. He would whip any kid, including him, who came near. And then he'd start beating his wife, my father's mother. It was those days of no hope in a very poor part of the world. He hated his father. But one thing he did was to say, as a young man receiving those whippings, if ever I have a child, he determined, I will never treat him like that. Even though he was a victim of what we call domestic abuse, violence, it changed him. It made, when he was on the receiving end of this, he said, no, I'm not going to do that to anybody else. So when I was growing up, it was my mother was a disciplinarian. My father just gave me love upon love upon love because of how he was brought up. That's what my father was, so tolerant, so kind. So when he died, imagine how guilty I felt. I should have treated that man much better. I should have said sorry, but I didn't take the opportunity of saying sorry now. You don't know when the person you love, your parents, grandparents, wife, husband, children, you don't know how long they're going to be there. That's why we have to express these emotions of respect, care, fondness, forgiveness now, because tomorrow is basically too late. If we know the importance of now, we never leave it to another occasion. If you want to do some charity, you have to do it now. Tomorrow you're broke, you can't do it. Every act of charity which I've given in my life, I've never ever regretted. Not only did, I think I told that story when a Buddhist nun came to give a talk when I was at university. I was so inspired by what she said and about the work she was doing for orphans. I took £10 out of my bank account, 2 weeks' food money that was. I had to go hungry. I didn't starve, but I didn't eat well for 2 weeks. So I could give that money, I was only a student, to give that money to some orphans in the north of India. I'm so proud I did that. That's given me happiness every time I think of it. I did it then, now, because if I thought about it later, I just would not do it. This is what we mean about the importance of now. If you want to, those of you who are Buddhists thinking, shall I keep the five precepts, shall I not keep the five precepts, shall I really become a Buddhist, do it now. It's worthwhile. Tomorrow, it comes too late. Look at those people being on this retreat. It's been 9 days since I first came here. How quickly that's gone. It's a flash since I first came to Penang. Now it's all gone. Now has to be the most important time. As they say in the West, grab the moment, because it's so fleeting, it passes by. What, or rather who, is the most important person? Emperor's question number two. This is Buddhist mindfulness and wisdom in work. When I heard that question, I thought, like many people might think, that I am the most important person. Or that some people might say that Jesus or Buddha or somebody else is the most important person. But the answer I read was so powerful in its depth and its practicalities. Literally, I was stunned for 2 or 3 days afterwards. The most important person in the world is the one you're with, whoever that happens to be. The most important person is the one you're with. Now look how that works in business. If you're with a client and you're not really giving them importance, you don't think you're going to get any contract from them, you don't really think they're interested in your product, you do not treat them as if they're important. You lose the contracts. If you have a client, a business associate, and you practice that they, in that moment, now, are the most important person in the world, for you, no matter whether you think you're going to get a contract or not, you will find they will know that you respect them, you're listening to their concerns, you're giving them a sense of importance. That means something to each one of us. You will get that contract. Too often in life, when we meet each other on a business or on a social level, we don't give each other importance. Have you ever had that happen to you? You've gone up to talk to somebody and you feel they're not listening to you. I read this story when I was at Cambridge as a student. Sometimes after a lecture, I'd have a question to ask the professor. I'd go up and ask him. He wasn't listening to me. To him, I was just a small student. I was not important. It's a rotten feeling when you really want to know, you want to ask a question, and they're not really listening. They're just trying to get rid of you. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever gone up to your mother and father? You really wanted to ask them or be with them, and they haven't been listening because they've been too busy. Or you wives, you husbands, have you ever wanted to talk to your partner about an important problem, and the other person is not really listening to you? It's amazing just how we take our wives, our husbands, sorry, our wife or our husband, people don't have two of each, or we take our parents, we take our children for granted. We don't give them the sense of importance. If you gave your partner the sense of importance I'm talking about, if when they came up to you, they felt that they were the most important person in the world in that moment for you, you'd find your relationship would blossom and grow. You'd have the most loving and caring relationship you could imagine. Your partner would feel important in your company. I'm saying this because your relationships, what you do at home, is such an important ingredient in your happiness in life. It's okay to talk about dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, but let's get this Buddhism into the nitty-gritty areas of your life. What happens between you and your husband, your wife, that is so important for your happiness and well-being in this life. So let's get that right, first of all. This is Buddhism in daily life. So you give your wife that sense of importance when they're talking with you. You give your husband that sense of importance. There's a story I should have brought up, I've got it in my room. It's a very fascinating story. It occurred in Harvard University about 30 or 40 years ago. You know Harvard University, the great university in the United States. There was a couple, poorly dressed, just in a homespun suit, and the wife in a simple dress, came into the president of Harvard's office. They asked to see the president. This was an important person, the president of Harvard University, the boss, the CEO. And the secretary said, "Have you got an appointment?" They said, "No, but we can wait." The secretary didn't want to hear that. She couldn't really give an answer. So she could just let those two people sit in the outer office, hoping they'd go away. But these two people, these very poor people, in ordinary suits, they just lingered in the office all morning. And she could not get rid of them. So she decided to go and disturb the president. She said, "I'm sorry to disturb you, sir, but there's a couple who want to see you. They've been waiting all morning. They haven't got an appointment, but I think maybe if they see you just for a few seconds, maybe they might go." And so the president huffed, went out from his office and saw these two people, obviously country hicks, in his office, and said, "What do you want?" And they told the president of Harvard that their son, their only son, had been at Harvard for 1 year. In the vacation, he had an accident and died. They told the president that their son loved being at Harvard. It was the happiest year of his life. So they wanted to build a memorial somewhere on campus for their loved, their dead son. The president said, "Look, we can't build a memorial for every person who dies. This is not a cemetery, this is a university." And they said, no, we don't want to build like a cross or more. We want to donate a building. At that, the president of Harvard looked at these poorly dressed couple and said to them, don't you know how much a building costs? We've got many, many millions, tens of millions of dollars of buildings in Harvard. That's how much this place costs. And at that, the couple were stunned. The president thought he could get rid of these country hicks now. But instead, the woman turned to her husband. Tens of millions of dollars. Is that all a university costs? Why don't we build our own? And Mrs. and Mrs. Leyland Stanford went back to their home in Palo Alto, California, and built their own university, Stanford. That was a very, very wealthy couple. Just because they wore cheap clothes didn't mean they didn't have a few million dollars in their account. And because the president of Harvard was not mindful, did not give those people a sense of importance, he lost a huge building for his university. That's what we mean about the person you're with is the most important. You don't judge them by their clothes. You don't know who they may be. That's how Stanford University started, just because somebody didn't recognize a kind person when they came in. I was just telling somebody an hour or two ago, in Western Australia, we've got a nun's monastery. How that nun's monastery started is also fascinating for you to hear. After our monk's monastery was reasonably well established and we had a city centre as well, which was doing well, we decided it was time to open the door for women to join the Sangha in Australia. So I put an article in our local newspaper, in our local newsletter, saying that we're now collecting funds for a nun's monastery. The money only trickled in until one day a man came to see me wearing jeans and an old shirt. He came to see me because he said he'd seen that article in our newsletter and his wife had just given birth to his first child, a daughter. He said he was a Buddhist and he wanted to do something to celebrate the birth of his first child. He'd read the article in our newsletter and said, I'm not sure if it will happen, but if my daughter, my baby girl, grows up and one day wants to become a nun, I want to help her by donating some money for your nun's monastery. I thought that was very kind, but I was quite taken aback when he took out a checkbook and wrote out a check for $250,000. I never expected a man in dirty jeans to have that sort of money. And that's how our nun's monastery started. Because I gave him importance, because I cared, therefore, that's what happens. In business, even in monk business, you have to care. And you have to give importance to the person you're with. What that really means is you listen. You're mindful, you're compassionate to the one you're with. You can always do that, whether it's a client, your husband. That's how I practice every day. Those of you on this retreat, when you came for your interviews, I really listened. You may have seen me leaning forward to make sure I caught every word. For you, when you came in that interview, you were the most important person in the world for me then. There's no one in the rest of the world, just you. That's why I listened. That's why I could communicate. Whenever anyone asked me a question, even after these talks, I practiced that. You who are talking to me become the most important person in the world. It's called communication. And the most important thing to do is to care. Beautiful answer, which means being careful and being caring. Those are the answers to the empathy questions. When is the most important time now? Who is the most important person, the one you're with? what's the most important thing to do? To care. I've given that story many, many times. It happened a few years ago. I received an invitation in the post to give the keynote address at a seminar for head teachers and other people in the education department in Western Australia. I did not know why I was invited to give the keynote speech. What was I to do with education, I thought. I went along, they were giving a free breakfast, amongst like free breakfasts. That wasn't the only reason I went along. But when I arrived there in the morning, I didn't know anybody. And I walked into the hall where they're holding this conference, this seminar, and somebody with a name tag came to meet me. As they came to meet me, I saw from their name tag they were the main organizer of this conference. Straight away they came up to me and said, "Do you remember me?" That is a terrible question to ask anybody. It's so embarrassing that sometimes people don't tell the truth. They say, "Oh yeah, I remember you," as you think quickly, "Who are they? Who are they?" But I'm a monk, so I have to tell the truth. So I said, "No, I don't remember you." Fortunately, she wasn't offended. She laughed, and she reminded me who she was. She said around 7 years previous to this encounter, to this seminar, she had been a headmistress at a school in Perth, at which I had given a talk. During that talk, I had mentioned the Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. The one you're with is the most important person. The most important thing to do is to care. It so impressed her that the following day she resigned. She gave up her well-paying job as a headmistress, which she'd worked for so many years to attain. She gave it up. For a long time, she had thought she wanted to do something which made more of a difference. She wanted to do something for the homeless children in Perth, the people who were living on the streets, taking drugs, sniffing glue, young girls underage who were prostitutes, living a very, very low life. Some of these girls were only 13 or 14, they should be in school. There were people who had fallen through the gaps in society, run away from home, no parents, no hope, only pain and suffering, mainly prison in front of them if they lasted that long. She wanted to help them. So she gave up her job straight away the following morning. And she decided to start a program to help these children in Perth. The Emperor's Three Questions was the philosophy behind her program. Now was the most important time. She didn't wait a day. She did it that following morning. She went to see those children, to find them on the streets. She had the courage to go up to them. But when she went up to them, she said in her heart, "That child, that glue sniffer, that underage prostitute, to me they're the most important person in the world, and the most important thing to do is to care." She told me that many of those children, for the first time that somebody came up to them and gave them a sense of importance, they were not being regarded as dross, as rubbish, something to be thrown away. They were being cared for. Someone was listening. She said because of that attitude, these street kids, these street children, opened up to her, told them their stories, many of them just so horrendous, so painful, would make you cry. They also said, they suggested what it would take to get them back into a school system, back into life. She took what they said seriously, and she went home, devised a program. She went to the education department, to the people in authority, and using, "Now's the most important time, you are the most important person, the most important thing to do is to care," she managed to sell that program to the people who control the purse strings. She got funding. And that program worked. This seminar was to celebrate that program. It took kids off the street. These were children who would be robbing homes, maybe molesting people, attacking people, the drug addicts, the drug pushers, prostitutes, the sort of people who we think are life's losers. She took them in, gave them an education, and now her first success stories were going to university. I tried to give the keynote speech. I was completely surpassed when two of these kids came up after me. They were not articulate. What they said was not good English, but they spoke from the heart. They made me cry. This boy, drug pusher, drug user since he was 11 or 12, got up and said, "I've got my marks, I'm going to university." He had his place. The girl came up, a young prostitute for so many years. She was finishing off her high school. All because this lady gave them a sense of importance. She cared. Now was the time to do this. That was one of the most inspiring moments of my life as a monk. It showed me what can be done if we live by Buddhist principles. Now is the most important time. Mindfulness in the present moment. You are the most important person. It means really being mindful, being alert. That's what this mindfulness business is all about. When someone is with you, you are fully listening to them. You're mindful of them. You're opening your heart completely to them. You're not just opening the door, you're throwing the door off the hinges. That's how you're opening to another person. You're not second-guessing what they're trying to tell you. You are listening with an open mind and an open heart. If we could only listen to each other, if we could only understand where we were coming from, what our problems were, how many times you have to go to a marriage counsellor, to a psychologist, to a child counsellor. Listen, you don't need to go to those counsellors. Coming to Mahindarama on a Friday, on a Sunday evening is much cheaper, more effective, more convenient. This is priceless teachings, not free. That's why the monks actually go to teach the psychologists. I also was giving a keynote speech at a grief seminar, an Australia-wide grief seminar, which was to be held in Perth. I gave a presentation at the question time afterwards. These professors, they pointed to me, "Ask him, he's the expert." 2 or 3 weeks ago, before I came here, I went on a radio show, a talkback show in Perth. I should have been a bit more careful because I didn't know what type of show I was going on. It was an adult show. I was on with a sexologist. The sexologist and the monk answering questions over the phone on people's personal problems. It was me who answered most of those questions. They asked, "Can I see the monk?" It was too hard for them to call me Ajahn Brahma Wangso. I tried Ajahn Brahma would be okay. Even Brahm, but they couldn't get that right. So in the end we settled on Mr. Monk. So they say, "Can we speak to Mr. Monk, please?" And that was me. And why is it that they ask a monk about marriage problems, relationship problems, and why is it they hear me give one answer and they ring up and they want to ask me again, rather than this sexologist? You know, after the show, I just did so much of the work on that show. I did all the questions, basically. At the end of the show, the sexologist got this big, fat paycheck. All I got was a bar of chocolate. But then again, I thought, you can't eat checks, you could eat chocolate, and the chocolate was actually quite delicious. So I think I got the better pay. But why is it this happens? It is because the psychology of Buddhism is so powerful. Look at that grief. Whenever people come up to me and they say they're grieving. I tell them that the story, this is again Buddhism in a modern approach, the story of my father's death and why I never cried. Why I've never ever felt grief over my father's death. And I've already told you, mentioned how much I love that man and how much I look up to him and how much he was, you know, maybe my first teacher, even more so than my mother. He told me so much about forgiveness and kindness because he had been so badly beaten as a young boy himself. When my father died, I never cried. I never felt sad at all. I didn't know why at the time. It was hard for me to explain it to myself. So, I had to find some sort of simile for my life to explain how I felt. And I came up with the simile of the concert. And I tell this simile at every funeral service as a monk, which I perform. When I was a young man in London, I loved music. I would go to many venues to see some of the great performers of the world. Great orchestras, rock bands, Jimi Hendrix, seen him many times, Rolling Stones. Whatever it was, I went to see those bands and those orchestras. Folk, rock, jazz, anything, I loved a lot. And sometimes in those days, you could see some amazing performers. I remember going to one place once. It was the top of a pub in London, the upstairs floor. There was a band playing there, and only six people turned up to listen to this band. And I was really quite impressed the band actually played. Their lead singer later became famous, now known as Rod Stewart. You can just shake hands with him if you want, because there's only six of us listening to the bloke. Those were the days when people who were later become famous were just starting out in their life. I love music. Those of you who've been to London might understand this story, because in the evening, at night time, when you go to a theatre or you go to a concert, after the concert is finished, you go outside and it's so gloomy and cold. I always remember London as raining. It's called drizzle. This depressing type of rain. It's not really raining at all, not like a monsoon in Penang. It's sort of, you know, half raining. It can't do anything, you know, properly. And it's always cold and gloomy. And you always got the lights of the lamppost just shining off the wet ground. It's a dismal place to be at night in London in the winter time. But at the end of every concert, when the music was finished, like everyone else, it was a really good performance. I'd stand up, I'd clap, I'd shout for more, 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 more. Just like you do at the end of a good performance. And very often, the musician, the orchestra, or the band, they'd carry on for a while. But they could only carry on for so long. And then they had to pack up their instruments and go home. They had a home to go to, so did I. So when they packed up their instruments, I had to leave the concert hall. And even though I knew the concert was over, and the chances of me listening to such a great band again were probably zero. I'd probably never listen to such great music again. Even though I knew the concert was over, when I walked out into the cold, gloom, wet of the London night, never once, never once did I feel sad. I never cried after a great performance. In fact, I felt inspired. I felt gratitude. What a wonderful performance that had been, and how lucky I was to have been there at the time, that I could actually listen to such great music. I was so fortunate. And that is exactly how I felt when my father died. I was at his bedside, clapping and shouting for more, as it were. He survived a couple of times, but then he finally passed away. The concert was over. The great times we had would be no more. But I never felt sad. I never felt like crying. I never have. What a wonderful time we had together, those 16 years. What a great father that was. And how privileged, how lucky I was to have been there for those years. It was like a great concert had come to an end. And I was inspired and moved. I never cried and felt sad, because I only remembered what I'd had. You only cry when you think of what's been taken away. You feel inspiration when you realize what you've had. When someone in your life dies, how do you feel? To you, is it like a great concert? You've known that person, maybe your mother, your father, maybe a husband, maybe a wife, maybe even a child. A child has come into your life who dies maybe 6 or 7 years old. A short performance, but what a wonderful concert that has been. Can you shout with joy how lucky I was to have known that little being for 6 years? What a great performance that was. And how you go out of that concert hall, for me, the crematorium, feeling blessed and privileged rather than feeling grief. It's a different way of looking at something like grief. When I told that story in Perth at the grief conference, everyone sat silent. They were shocked. They never heard that you can look upon death in a Buddhist way. Another way, a more happy way, a more meaningful way. You never forget a man who you loved so much. You never forget a child, a mother or a father. But you remember them not with grief, but with gratitude, with inspiration. What a wonderful life that was. And when you remember them like that, you try to live up to that memory. You try and be a better person as a result. You try and live up to the performance which they've given you, to try and repeat it in your lives. So instead of feeling grief, we feel inspired. And we live up to that inspiration. And we're better people as a result. Why can't you do that? Why not you? How many tears are shed in death, especially of tragic deaths, people who shouldn't die. My father shouldn't have died at 16, he was only 42, 43. He had still many years left in front of him, but that's what happens. But those 42 years, especially the last 16, they were wonderful years. The best part of the performance, and I was there to see it. Wow, I was so lucky. So, are you going to cry when I leave tomorrow? Are you going to say what a wonderful performance that was, how lucky we feel? This is what we mean about celebrating the time we have together. It's a Buddhist way. Now is the most important time. The most important thing to do is to care. It's mindfulness in the moment. Not only that, but we're creating these wonderful positive qualities. It's called forgiving the faults, celebrating the beauty. In a garden, you've got both weeds and flowers. What do? Most people water the weeds and they neglect the flowers. No wonder their garden gets covered in weeds. What I mean there is the problems in life, the difficulties in life, the pain in life. Because we give that all of our attention, because that's what we focus on, that's what we think about. We're watering the weeds in life and we think this world is a terrible place. There's wars going on, there's problems, there's difficulties. Look at all the trouble in the world. All the suffering when you look at the news or read the newspapers. It's only the weeds which get in the newspapers. Because it's only the weeds which get your attention. They get watered. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a newspaper which said all the wonderful things which were going on in the world? For example, look at monks. The only monks who get in the newspapers are the monks who get caught doing unsavory things. The scallywag monks. I never get in the newspapers. If I want publicity, I've got to do something wrong. Isn't that the case? How many good people are there in Perth? Good people in Penang? They never get in the newspapers. Look at it this way. I was telling this the other day. When I went to Singapore a couple of years ago, in the middle of the SARS crisis, and people were worried sick about SARS. It's the fear which kills people, not the virus. Because it was in the newspapers that morning, 99 people, it was almost to 100, they were waiting it to tick over to 100, 99 people had died of SARS. And so I told people, if 99 people have died of SARS, it means that 2,999,001 haven't died of SARS. So you've got almost 20,000 to 1 chance of not getting SARS. That's nothing. What we're saying there, we look at things in the other way, in a positive way. We're watering the flowers rather than watering the weeds in life. That's called kindness and caring. Look at you. Are you worried about your faults, the things you've done wrong, your mistakes in life? Or do you celebrate your goodness, the kind things you've done? Each one of us has done more good karma than bad karma in this life. You are good people. The human realm is a good realm. Most people are very, very good people. But why is it we never remember the good karma we've done? But we do one act of bad karma, and my goodness, we remember that again and again and again. We torture ourselves because of our faults. Why on earth do we do that? I say to people, you've got this huge store of good karma. You should be so happy. The good karma is like money in the bank. But you have forgotten the PIN number. You don't know how to get it out of your account. You made all this charity, you kept all your precepts, you've been kind and caring, looked after your parents, looked after your wife, husband, your children, done all the right things. Why aren't you happy? Because you don't know how to draw the money out of your account. You've forgotten the PIN number. I will tell you this evening the PIN number to get the happiness out of your mind, out of your store of good karma. You just remember it. You keep thinking about it. You reflect upon it again and again, what the Buddha called Chaganusati, the meditation which remembers your good qualities. Why don't people do that? Why is it always remember all the faults we've done, our mistakes, and we feel so rotten about ourselves? You know, sometimes people commit suicide because of that. All they can think of is their mistakes, and they forget anything good about themselves. At a funeral in the United States recently, a wife had just lost her husband. When the wife got up to give the eulogy, to say a few words about her husband, she held up a piece of paper. This piece of paper her husband had carried around all his life. He'd got this piece of paper well before he met his wife. She said whenever he was upset, depressed, he'd always get out this piece of paper which he kept in his wallet, and it always cheered him up. She told the story of that piece of paper. She said when they were in grade school in the United States, there was an argument in the class, a fight developing. The two sides of the class were enemies. The teacher called a halt and gave them a piece of paper each and told them to draw a line down the middle of the piece of paper. They were told to think or to write on the top the name of one of their enemies, and in the left-hand column write down all they hated, all the faults in that rotten person they hated, their enemy. And then when they completed the left-hand column, to write on the other side all the things they liked and appreciated about that person they hated. Then the school teacher collected up all those pieces of paper, tore them in half along the line, all the things which somebody didn't like about you, she screwed that up and put in a waste bin, and all the things that someone liked about you, she gave out to the people concerned. He had that list ever since he was young in school about what his enemy liked about him. And he kept that in his wallet. Whenever he was angry himself, that reminded him of all of his good qualities. The kindness which he'd done in his life, the goodness. It was a way of remembering the noble qualities, the good karma which he'd performed. When she finished saying that, she was surprised that 5 or 6 other people in the funeral service, people sitting down, who were also in that same class, the lifelong friends, also took a piece of paper out of their wallets or their purses and held it up. They too had kept those mementos of kindness, and they too had used those reflections to help them through the black periods of their life. Whenever we get depressed, whenever we have this lack of self-esteem, we can think of nothing good about ourselves, which is why we even might want to kill ourselves. Or we might want to get lost in alcohol or drugs, which is a slow suicide. All we need to do is to water a few flowers, to see some good qualities in ourselves, to have that positive sense, to open up our good karma account by pressing the pin number of I remember. And when you do that, you find you're not such a bad person after all. In fact, you're a very beautiful person. Otherwise, you would not be reborn in this human realm. When you recall the good qualities in yourself, a strange thing happens. You are watering the flowers and not the weeds. Your good qualities grow, and they grow and they grow. You understand what this positive forgiveness I was saying the other day means. How we grow in good qualities. How our good karma gets more and more the more we remember our good karma of the past. When we forgive the bad karma, it's not watered anymore. It just disappears, diluted by the effects of our wonderfully good karma. This is how we water down the bad karma. This is how we dilute it. The weeds disappear from our garden. Your heart, the flowers grow. Lack of self-esteem is not there anymore. We don't need alcohol and drugs. We don't need props. We feel good about ourselves. We have inner happiness. We're at peace. When you're happy and at peace with yourself, only then do you know how to be happy and at peace with others. You become a person who can give a positive contribution to this world. A positive contribution to your family, to your society, to your company, to your country, to the world. This is what we need, that positive mind state, all grown from Buddhist psychology, of learning how to grow flowers rather than weeds. So we live this Buddhism, this Dharma, this truth, and it solves so many problems in our life. A death happens, we're not upset. We don't get depressed. We don't water the weeds. But we become happy people, effective people, energetic people, people who can serve in this society. That's what we need. The reason why I became a Buddhist, because I saw that Buddhism was a path to happiness. It solved my problems, never made more. So I started living this Buddhism. I started making the Dharma my life, and I really took it on board and had a full commitment. You don't need to be a monk or a nun, but if you commit yourself to these Buddhist teachings, there's a whole wealth of psychology, philosophy, which actually works, which solves every problem you can imagine in your life and turns it into something positive. Good karma, happiness. Good karma is just a bank of potential happiness. And you can get it any time you like to bring joy to your life and happiness to others. So I talked in the beginning about the Emperor's Three Questions. That's Buddhism in a nutshell. Remember, the only time you ever have is now. The most important thing to do is to care, and the one you're with. sometimes you're with yourself. Who's the first person you see when you wake up in the morning? Yourself. Do you say, good morning me, here I am again? I do. I go into the habit of saying, good morning me, here I am again, have a good day. Who's the last person you see when you go to sleep at night? You. Do you say to yourself, good night, have a nice sleep? Please be kind to yourself. It helps. Good morning, good night me, have a nice time. When you do that, you're recognizing that you are an important person. The one you're with is the most important. If you recognize that you are an important person, what should you do next? Care. Please care about yourself. And when should you care? Now. Don't wait till tomorrow to care about yourself. To care means bringing happiness and peace in your heart. So that is living the Dhamma. I became a Buddhist because I saw that Dhamma working. I remained as a Buddhist because I saw the effects, the results of that Dhamma in action. I saw some of the happiest, most effective people in my life. People in the West are seeing the effects of such Dhamma. Down to earth, practical teachings which anybody can put into practice. As even saying today, even with meditation, we get referrals from specialists who send their clients to the monastery or to our center to do meditation or learn Buddhism. They prefer them to learn Dhamma rather than give them all these medicines to get rid of depression, to get go or to decrease their blood pressure. Buddhism works so well that people get sent to learn Dhamma. Because it's cheaper and better than going to a medical specialist. It's also, in a medical specialist you have to make an appointment and sometimes wait for weeks. Here, you can listen to it on CD, anytime you like. So there we go, that's this evening's talk on sort of Buddhism in daily life, or living the Dhamma, and why not you? Do you want to be happy? So now you know how to do it. Do you want to be rich? Now you know how to do it. Do you want to be successful? No. Now you know how to do it. So thank you for listening to this ninth talk. Okay, now, before I get the paper questions, is there any questions from the floor about what I've just said? Any comments or anything? Was that understandable, empathy questions? Because sometimes that I've asked people who go to my talks in Perth, just after the talk when I'm going out, I ask them, so what did I talk about this evening? Well, I'm not really sure, but it was good. A lot of times all they remember the jokes. It's quite depressing really, but now you remember a story. And when you remember that story, try it out, see if it works. So it's much better to tell stories which people remember. And then they actually practice. Okay, let's go for the first question. If a lay person is a first or second stage Arya, do you think that the wife would have bad karma since she may inflame his sensual desires? Oh, you've got some really strange questions. It's so rare to find a first or second stage Arya in the lay life. That it's a question which almost never comes up. But really it's up to you and your partner to discuss these things. And surely that a partnership should be two-way, looking after one another, caring for each other. And so if one of the partners doesn't want sex, the other person should respect that. Or if one does, the other one should get to some sort of compromise. Talk it out. Be kind. Be caring. Don't just be selfish, be selfless. You're not an individual anymore once you get married. They say in Thailand, you're an elephant. You've got 4 feet, not 2 now. And if the 2 front feet and the 2 back feet go in opposite direction, that elephant falls over. If an elephant is walking, the 2 front feet and the 2 back feet have to cooperate. That's what marriage is all about. It's cooperation. So don't be an elephant who keeps falling over, husbands and wives. You have to compromise. The elephant's front feet and back feet can compromise. Why can't you? Look at a centipede. That's got 100 feet. And they never sort of go around in circles. They cooperate. Surely you can. Next question. Do you think it is accurate to say that there is birth but no one is born, there is death but no one dies? If yes, then there is a better world here, word rebirth, as it implies someone is born. That's just a technicality. Sometimes we call reincarnation, sometimes rebirth. It depends on which way you look at it. Yeah, technically there's no one who's really born, but a process is born. But for most people, it's no difference in saying sort of a person is reborn. That's how it seems to most people. So that's good enough. It's like when I was at primary school, I was taught the law of gravity. What goes up goes down. Now that's pretty accurate. In most situations, that's good enough. Like the law of reincarnation, that's good enough. However, when I went to a high school, I was taught Newton's law of gravity, that masses attract each other according to the product of their masses divided by the square of the distance apart, times big G. And I thought that was pretty accurate, until I went to university. And then I learned all about Einstein's general theory of relativity, which showed that masses warp space-time. Now that's only relevant in very, very rare and refined cases. So it really depends on the sort of the context which you're talking in. If I taught the general theory of relativity to kids at primary school, I would get nowhere. So yeah, okay, it's true to say that really there's no one born in when someone there's no one born when there's a birth, technically speaking, yeah. But that's so refined. It's like Einstein's general theory of relativity. Let's leave it to the university professors. Let's leave it to when you're really into this meditation and understand non-self. But for all intents and purposes, that you are reborn. That's how you feel it anyway. If you remember your past lives, like I said yesterday, then that's how you experienced it, that was you. So it doesn't really matter, rebirth or reincarnation, it's all the same to me. Whether you call it noodles or you call it spaghetti, it all tastes delicious to me. I have been giving in so much, even to the extent of sacrificing my own self, need for my mother. But not only does she not appreciate it, she is not contented. What should I do? She always takes advantage of our compassion. Please advise. Now you said you've been giving in so much. You haven't been giving in enough if you want to be appreciated. Being appreciated is not giving, it's doing business. I will give to you, Mother, as long as you appreciate me. That's not selfless. That's wanting something back in return. It's like somebody gives a donation. And you know I don't receive donations, it just goes in a box. So it's not appreciated. I don't say, oh, what a wonderful person you are. Oh, you. And I give an announcement. So-and-so gave 5 ringgit. So-and-so gave 10 ringgit. Oh, you feel so happy. But you don't get any appreciation from me. You know why? Because that wouldn't be giving then. That would be doing business. I give a donation in order for my name to be put on the wall. That's buying. When you give, it has to be not expecting anything back in return at all. You're just giving for the sake that person needs it. You're giving for the sake of giving. You're giving for letting go. You're giving out of love. When you give a gift to your child, do you expect anything back? You just give because you want to give. A gift is an act of love, appreciation, gratitude. We give to our loved ones. We want to give to them, that's all. We just, please accept something. And this is what real giving is. If you give something to your wife on February the 14th, Valentine's Day, and if you expect something back in return, you don't really love her. You're just wanting something back. It's bribery, that's all. So really it should be giving from your heart. You're just giving for the sake of giving. You're giving because I love her. I don't care what you do with it. I just need to give it to you. I want to give it to you. So this is actually what we really mean. Sometimes when I give a talk, I don't expect any appreciation. I just give because I love giving. When I come to Penang, I just work hard, giving many talks. I don't care how many talks I give, I just enjoy it. Sometimes people say thank you. So what are you thanking me for? I'm just happy to give, to serve, to enjoy. So when you're going to so much to sacrifice yourself for the Buddhist of Penang, I don't need to be appreciated. That's real giving. If you want to have thanks afterwards, that's doing a business deal. So I think that's probably why she's not content, because you're not content. If you're really giving to your mother, how much did your mother give to you when you were born? How much did she care for you? As a baby, you woke her up in the middle of the night, and she got up and gave up her sleep for you. She carried you around in her womb for 9 months. So when she gave birth, it's usually quite painful. She did that for you. Did you ever show appreciation? You don't need to. A mother just wants to do that. She never waits for the baby to say, thanks, Mum. She just loves doing it. That's what real giving is. That's what care is. That's what love is. Love doesn't expect anything back in return. It's unconditional. I will give, not expecting back in return. If we can only do that in our life, we know how to love, we know how to give. Maybe your mother is not able to show appreciation. Maybe she is content, but she doesn't know how to say it. But you show the way. You just appreciate the fact you can care for somebody and be content to do that for your mother. She won't be around for that much longer. And if you are angry at her now, you'll feel so upset later on. You take advantage of her compassion. People take advantage of me all the time. I love it. Please take more advantage. Take. Thank you. Okay. Whoops. If a being exists, if a being exits the cycle of life in total nothingness, from where did the beginning come from? One can be easily contented with a simple life. Why seek to undo nature's structure? Okay, a being exits the cycle, where do beings come from? Where is the start? There is no start. If there was a start, what caused the start? It's very obvious as a scientist that the circle, the sphere, the roundness is the solution to beginnings and ends. A circle doesn't have a beginning and end, it just goes round and round and round. That's samsara. The latest laws of science, of physics, I always keep up with the modern theoretical physics. The latest laws of physics, or theories of physics, the one which explains natural phenomena the best, is of the colliding plane theory. Planes in several dimensions colliding. When they collide and pass through each other, that's what we call the Big Bang. These colliding plane theory from a couple of scientists from Cambridge and also from somewhere in the United States somewhere. This is the favorite theory at the moment for the arising of our universe. And it's fascinating that this does not predict just one universe, but many sequential universes, one after the other. Not just one Big Bang, but a series of unending Big Bangs. What they're saying is what scientists call the Big Bang was not the beginning of everything, was just the beginning of this universe. That is classic Buddhism, just as the Buddha said. The Buddha remembered because of his meditation, not just one past life, but 91 eons of past life. An eon is a time between one big bang and a big crunch. There's actually one sutra, a very obscure teaching of the Buddha, which when I came across, I realized that gave me a way to work out how long an eon was. And I worked it out, a very simple calculation. It came to something like 17,000 million years. No, sorry, 37,000 million years. As far as we know, that this universe is about 13,000 million years old. That is what we call in the ballpark. That's a credible figure. I was really impressed with Buddhism's calculation in the ancient texts of the age of a universe. So, beings, have not just been created. We've been evolving. Universes have come, universes have gone. It's not just the rebirth of people, it's the rebirth of universes. Everything comes and goes and gets reborn. Even our star, the sun, even our bodies. I learned as a physicist that the only way to make the elements, the higher elements such as iron, which form such an essential part of your body, is to have gone through two supernovae. Your elements in your body have been through two stellar explosions. And that's the only way that you, your body elements, could have been created. If you ask the elements, the atoms in your body, what their history was, twice they have gone through these amazing, they've been part of the stars. You are literally stardust, as the scientists say. Twice over, you've exploded. And now you've managed to drift to Earth, and this is part of your body. You've been in suns two times over. That's just ordinary science. Fascinating where you come from. That's your history. Did you know that? You are stardust. One can be easily contented with a simple life. Why seek to undo nature's structure? Because the nature of the human mind is to complicate things. We abhor simplicity. For example, in your house, in your home, what do you put on the walls? If you've got a nice clean wall there, people want to find a picture to put on that wall because you don't like it being empty. If you've got a corner, you like to put a pot plant in there or something. Every space in your house gets filled with knick-knacks. Even in nature, when we find a nice mountain, what do? We put a restaurant on top of it. What did the astronauts do when they got to the moon? Put a flag on it. We can't leave anything alone. Our nature is to complicate things. We've got a word for that in Buddhism, papancha, proliferation. We can't leave things alone without making them complex. Even Buddhism, the beautiful simple teachings of the Emperor's Three Questions, we complicate that so much. I'm going to get in trouble here, but even people have complicated Buddhism with the Abhidharma. Just complicated, simple, beautiful teachings have made it so unintelligible, basically. That's what I say. So the reason why we can't keep things simple, because it's part of our nature which wants to complicate things. Basically, human beings mess things up. Keep it simple. In your home, if you've got less furniture, it's much easier to do your housework. You don't need two televisions or three. Just have one and have the whole family come together and watch it. And if you can't make a decision amongst three or four people what you're going to watch in an evening, then there's no hope for our world. How can we ever decide? Dear Ajahn Brahm, why religion, please enlighten us? Is it a way of the more superior to control the lives of the inferior beings? My goodness, religions don't control at all. Real religions let go. Religions are based on love, not on control, not on domination. As I said to the yogis this morning, teachers, like monk teachers, want to get rid of disciples, not to get any more. I'm trying to teach you so you never have to come to Mahinda Rama for a talk ever again. You know it all, you're enlightened, you're at peace. I'm a big failure as a monk because people keep coming back again and again and again. In school, if I was a teacher at school and people came again and again repeating the same class, oh, I get the sack, you can't be any good. People are supposed to graduate from school. So real teachers try to get rid of disciples. Religion is supposed to free you, not put you in another jail. So real religion is not supposed to control the lives of anybody. Even the five precepts are voluntary. We give you the five precepts as a guideline for your life. We don't say you have to keep the five precepts. And if you don't keep the five precepts, you can never come to Mahinda Rama temple ever again. You are excommunicated. There's no such thing like that in Buddhism. It's guidance. It's helping people take responsibility for their lives. Giving them some guidance. Buddhas only show the way. Each one of us takes responsibility to walk that way. And if you refuse to walk the way, or if you walk the way, I will still be your friend. No matter what you do. I'm not going to control you. Never will, never have. That's called freeing. Hence, what makes Buddhism so unique or special that can make itself amenable to the lesser beings like us? You are not a lesser being. Each one of you is not a higher being either. You are just you. And I'm very happy to have you as you and no one else. Be kind to yourself. Love yourself for who you are. Compassion is tenderness and acceptance. If you can accept yourself who you are, if you're at peace with yourself, then all those things you don't like about yourself will disappear. All anger, all actions of hurt, all come from a person not being at peace with themselves. If someone was at peace with themselves, loved themselves, were kind to themselves, they would never hurt any other being in the world. They would never be cruel. They would never be mean. The only reason we do this is because we're hurting ourselves, we spread hurt to others. Love yourself and you will love all other beings in the world. Hate yourself and you'll have only hate in your heart to give to the people around you. It's an old teaching. I've seen it work again and again and again. When people forgive themselves, come to peace with themselves, then they don't create any more harm in the world. They create harmony, which is very different than harm. Ajahn, knowing cigarettes are bad for the health, would selling cigarettes constitute wrong livelihood? Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, actually, I usually tell people if you sell cigarettes, it's usually wrong livelihood. If you have a shop which sells cigarettes, maybe take the cigarettes off the shelf and maybe sell something else. Because, yeah, I mean, cigarettes are known to be so bad. And so why are we doing that? If at all possible. You have to be practical. If that's your livelihood, then give yourself time to see if you can change your livelihood. When anyone is doing things like that, you don't say, that's really bad, stop immediately. You give them a time to try and find another job, find another means of livelihood. Dear Ajahn Brahm, your teacher Ajahn Chah can only speak Thai. How did you manage to learn from him? Actions speak louder than words. That's what I learned from Ajahn Chah. His actions were brilliant. Eventually I learned Thai, so I could learn his speech. But most of what was inspiring was not what he said, but what he did. It's the same with any teacher. Someone could come along and sit here and give a far more articulate talk, more eloquent, more inspiring than what I'm doing. But it's where it's coming from, people keep saying. It's how you act. What you do is more important than what you say. So it's important that Ajahn Chah, which is so inspiring in the way he behaved. And that's what I learned from him. To cultivate good behavior, rather than just cultivate learning how to give a smart talk. Keeping off pets like cats and dogs at home, is that considered bad karma? What if we save some strays and bring them home for shelter and food? That would be very nice, if you possibly can do that, to look after a couple of cats, strays or dogs, because they'll always repay your kindness, you know, many, many times over. Sometimes, though, that you can't actually look after every cat and dog, so sometimes you have to try and keep them off, but it's so hard to do so. In our monastery, you might not believe this, that sometimes I have to keep off the kangaroos. The kangaroos in our monastery are so tame now, you wouldn't believe it. They'd never run away, they usually run towards you. One of the monks, not so long ago, he got his meal of the day in his alms bowl. We eat out of our alms bowl in Perth. He went back to his hut to eat his food. He just left the bowl on the veranda. It was a hot day, he was going to eat outside. He just went in for 1 minute. When he came back, he saw a kangaroo with his nose in his bowl. The kangaroo was picking out the food before he got to it. the kangaroos. So sometimes when that was happening to me, you try to push the kangaroo away. The kangaroo just wouldn't go. I got a stick up out, you know, the broom, to try and hit the kangaroo. I just couldn't do it. I tried to hit it, but no, how can you hit a kangaroo? I'm a monk. I thought I should do so, and I just let it take some food. So it's much kinder looking after animals, and the animals become your friends. And living with friends in my monastery is so wonderful. You know, just about 2 years ago, on one of the hot days, a huge tiger snake came to see me. It was 2.5 meters long. The snakes in Australia are far more venomous than the snakes in Malaysia. Australia's got the most dangerous snakes in the world, and this was one of them. Came straight towards me. I just looked at it and spread loving kindness. And he looked at me and looked at me. And I was washing my bowl after the meal, so I carried on washing my bowl. I ignored it. He could have struck me very easily. I ignored it. I did my business. When I turned around, it had turned around too. Its tail was pointing at me, and its head was 2.5 meters in the opposite direction. It looked like it was protecting me. I could have killed it very easily because it wasn't facing me. It was its most vulnerable portion. Its tail was next to me. When you're kind to animals, animals are always kind to you. They protect you, even the snakes. There are many stories of animals and monks. I'll tell another story about animals and monks. Once when I was coming back from Sri Lanka, I've been visiting Sri Lanka, and it was one of those late night flights. And when I came to Perth Airport and was queuing up at the immigration terminal, a customs officer came with a sniffer dog. You know these sniffer dogs which are there to sniff drugs? And he took them up and down the line of people waiting at the immigration counter, up and down, up and down. When it came to me, the dog stopped. It did. It put its nose in my robe and wagged its tail furiously. And the handler had to sort of drag it off forcefully. When it did that, everyone looked around at me. The person in front of me took a step further away in front. The one behind stepped back. But we're not with that one. No, it's nothing to do with us. And those of you who've been to Perth know that immigration queue is very, very slow. The handler had cut time, another 5 minutes, to come round a second time, up and down the line. When it came to me, it stopped a second time, buried its head in my robe, around my chest, and he had to drag it away. So, when I actually went to the customs, my goodness, they checked me out. But, you know, you don't carry much as a monk, so, you know, you don't have to unload very much. And then when he couldn't find anything, he said, where are the drugs? I said, look, I don't take any drugs. I haven't given up drugs years and years and years and years ago. Don't even take alcohol. He said, well, why did that dog stop at you? He said, look, loving kindness. Get out of here, said the customs man. That's a true story. That's what happens when you're kind. You get into trouble because the customs dogs like you. Okay. Venerable, I have the same dreams over and over again. Does it have any connection to my past life? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It depends what those dreams are. It may be you're drinking too much coffee at night. I know this Penang coffee is very strong. It really depends on what those dreams are. If they are repeated again and again, sometimes it is something trying to tell you something. It could be a past life, it could be anything. So you have to find out by giving me more details later on. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'd like to understand the reason why some Buddhists believe that when a person dies, the body must not be moved for 8 to 12 hours, as the soul is around and the body will be in pain. Is this the correct practice as taught by the Lord Buddha? No, it's not. You can move the body as soon as possible. The person doesn't feel any pain at that time. Just in the same way that those people are meditating, when the 5 senses disappear, when your body disappears, you don't feel any pain. Do you? Not at that time. You're experiencing in your meditation what it's like to be dead. So you know for yourself as a direct personal experience what's happening. People don't feel pain at that time. So you can move the body, do whatever you like. You can take out the organs straight away. The person won't feel it. Their body has basically separated from their mind. In the same way that when you get into deep meditation, you can't feel the body. The hands have disappeared, the legs, the head has disappeared. At that stage, if someone touched you, you wouldn't notice it. If a mosquito bit you, you wouldn't notice it. So if a person has died, then you can move them, you can do whatever you like to them. They won't feel a thing. If I'm wrong, and it happens to you, you come back and haunt me. It doesn't happen. Do we have delusion when we meditate? As far as I know, delusions and truths are very subjective. How do you distinguish between delusions and truths? Okay, the way you distinguish between delusions and truth, once there is no desire or aversion in your mind, you're not in denial. That's what aversion means. I don't want to see this. Once there's no wishful thinking that I want to see this, I want this to happen, once those two hindrances have disappeared, then and only then can you trust that what you're seeing is accurate and truthful. The point is, we don't see what's real, we see what we want to see. I was just checking the manuscript earlier. I recall the time I had my first glass of British beer. You know, in many countries, you know, like in Europe, like England, they have a special type of beer they like. No one else in the world likes that beer. And the ones they drink in pubs, bitter beer, ale. And when I was young, I had my first glass of beer. I was underage. I was just, you know what it's like being a young boy, you're trying to rebel. Your friends were egging you on. So I went into a pub, I was underage, I got my first glass of beer. I was being big. But when I drank that beer, I couldn't believe how awful it tasted. It tasted terrible. I thought, why would anybody pay money for this? And why do people in England spend all their time on a Saturday night, Friday night, going and drinking gallons of this stuff? But according to the culture in England at the time, beer was a thing to drink. I wanted it to taste delicious. Because I wanted it to taste delicious, after a very short while, it started tasting delicious. I bent the truth to suit what I wanted to believe. Fascinating. An experience in my life. Peer pressure made me change my taste buds. How often is it that you may have had some food, and it tastes delicious, until you find out what it really was? This is also the way of our perception. So, delusion is when we are in denial or when we have wishful thinking. So it's only when those two are out of the way, and the job of meditation is to completely abandon wishful thinking. So you don't want Buddhism to be right or wrong, you don't have any vested interests in what you find out when you investigate truth. You are open, courageous to see things as they truly are, not desiring anything for the outcome. And you're not afraid of anything either. You're not in denial. You're not hiding from the truth because it doesn't suit you. You're fully open to whatever's out there. And that's what we call truth seeking. And you meditate to overcome these very, very pernicious and very, very deep forces of delusion. Desire and ill will. We see what we want to see, it's called desire. We block out what we don't want to see, which is called ill will. That's why we're deluded. Next question. This is very nice, someone's actually printed this out. May I say you spent almost 95% of your time in a monastic environment whereby folks around you clearly understand you and your intentions. I don't know about that. For a person to let go and adopt good wisdom like practicing the following, the lay people around us usually interpret as following. Doing dana often may be interpreted as I am rich and can easily afford it. No, it doesn't. Sometimes it's interesting actually, giving donations. It has been well known in like Western countries especially, when people go seeking donations door to door, they always avoid the rich suburbs, because the rich suburbs always give the less. The least. You go to the poor suburbs and they give the most. Poor people generally speaking, that are more generous. Strange. Don't know why. It's only generally speaking. Maybe poor people understand they need to make more dana so they can get rich in their next life. I don't know. That's what happens. That's how you become rich. Being kind-hearted and helpful in the administration may be interpreted that I'm scared of my staff. I've always found that people who are kind-hearted and helpful are actually loved by their staff. They're appreciated by their staff, and the staff protects them. Not only do they respect them, but they look after them. If someone says they're scared, that's no. Usually when we control other people, that's when we're scared. We have to let go of our guard, let go of our ego to be kind and caring. We have to be selfless. Being compassionate and honest may be interpreted I am holy and religious and people will take advantage. Remember the holy, the bad snake yesterday? You can always hiss, but you don't need to bite, in that story I said yesterday. Being compassionate and honest is never interpreted badly. How do I function in this uphill environment? Have a bit more faith, try these things out and see how they work. I don't just live in a monastic environment 95% of the time. Sometimes I have to deal with builders. Sometimes I go to the shops, the building shops, to get some things on our account. Look, this is what happened to me once. This is how Dharma can help you in your life make profits. The first year as a monk there, the first building we built was our ablution block, toilets and showers. Practical things for monks. Nothing sort of inspiring like a Dharma hall. The first building was toilets and showers. That's what the monks needed most. So I had to learn plumbing. I never plumbed anything before in my life, but we had the plans from an architect. I went to the biggest plumbing shop in Perth. It wasn't the biggest, but it was, you know, this quite well-known shop. And I literally put the plans on the counter and said to the man behind the counter, called Fred, help. And it's not that difficult to do plumbing. It's pretty common sense. And so he showed me how to put the parts together, gave me a bit of advice. He actually spent quite a long time with me. We got all the parts needed, which was quite a big order. And so the parts were delivered to the monastery, and I spent quite a few days putting it all together. Once it was put together, the local health inspector from the council had to come to test it out. It passed. I was so pleased. I was amazed. My first job actually passed the test. Nothing leaked. And I think it was about the next day or 2 days later, we got the letter, the bill from the plumbing company. So I got the treasurer to write out a cheque, and I sent the cheque to the plumbing company with a letter. The letter was basically saying, I'm so happy, 2 days ago the council officer came, they passed the plumbing, thanks a lot to Fred who helped me understand how to put things together. We couldn't afford a plumber, so without Fred's help and your company's help, we wouldn't have been able to do this. Thanks a million. And I sent that with a cheque. What I didn't realise at the time, that this plumbing firm had many, many branches. It was a big plumbing company over the whole of Australia. So when I sent that letter, it never went to Fred. It went to the accounts department, to a clerk in the accounts department. The clerk in the accounts department opened that letter, opened that envelope rather, saw a letter with the cheque, immediately assumed, oh no, another complaint. Because the only time people write letters with their cheques is to complain about something. But when they read that letter, it wasn't a complaint at all, it was a letter of praise. And they were so taken aback by this that the clerk took it to the head, the manager of the accounts department, who again was so surprised at getting a letter of praise that he took it to the managing director of the whole company. The managing director read it immediately, picked up the phone and called Fred in his branch office. With the letter on his mahogany table, he said, Fred, this is a wonderful letter we've got. He read it out, you know, the contents of what I'd written. He said, this is great company policy. This is what we want in our employers. This is the way forward. Well done, Fred. Yes, sir. How much are we paying you, Fred? I think we can do better, Fred. Yes, sir. It just happened that after that telephone call, which happened in the morning, that afternoon, I visited that plumbing shop again. There was one part which I had for another job which was too small. I needed to replace it with something bigger. There were two Australian plumbers ahead of me in the line, two big fellows with shoulders like pickaxes. As soon as Fred saw me, he pushed them aside and said, "Brahm, come over here. What can I do for you?" His mate sort of told me what had happened that morning. And I told Fred, "Look, I've got this part and it's too small." "Don't worry, Brahm, come in the back." There's a big sign that customers prohibited. He took me round the back to all the shelves. He said, what do you want? What do you want?" And I said, "Look, it's too small." He said, "This big enough for you?" "No." "This big? Yeah, that's the one I want." I got VIP service. Plumbers have been going to that firm for years, never got treated like I got treated. And then when I said, "Look, this is very much bigger, it must be more expensive, what's the difference?" And Fred said, "Brahm, for you, there is no difference." He let me have it for free. See, that's what happens when you practice Dhamma. You save a lot of money and you get VIP service. So, I live in that real world, and this is actually what happens. So, being compassionate and honest is not interpreted as being highly religious. People don't take advantage, you get benefits. Another time, we got some wood for building one of our huts from the local timber yard. There was so much wood that when we were sort of, you know, paying for it, putting it on the trolley, I found when I got back to my monastery, we'd missed a couple of pieces of timber. It wasn't on the bill. We didn't do it on purpose, we don't steal, but we hadn't paid for two pieces of timber. So the following morning I went back to the shop and told the guy, "Look, we got some timber the other day, it wasn't on the bill, here's those two pieces of timber, can you charge us for it?" And I remember that person on the counter saying, "What?" I said, "Look, you took this timber, you didn't charge us for it." And he shook his head in disbelief. He charged it up on the till, we had to pay for it. But from that time on, he gave us 10% discount, a builder's discount, usually only for builders, not for customers, every time we used that shop. What we paid for those two pieces of timber was nothing compared to the discount we got from that shop over the years, because we were honest. And another shop which we go to, the local hardware store, we're so honest there that one day I was choosing some paint for our monastery, choosing the colours. I had the colour brochure out, and there's so many people in that shop, I was looking for a place to open up the brochure so I could choose the right colour. And not being very mindful, just, you know, trying to hold the brochure, I was working to try and find a place, and I put the brochure on top of the till. And it was one of these electronic tills, very sensitive. I must have pressed the open button, because the cash, the drawer with all the cash, the day's taken, just opened right in front of me. All the other builders and other people at the counter stopped because they heard the ding, and they said, "You better look at that one," to the manager, looking to me. It looked, to all intents and purposes, I was going to steal the day's takings. The manager turned around to me, looked at him and said, "Oh no, he can't even touch the stuff." And he walked completely away. He trusted me with the day's takings, knowing that there's no way that I would ever steal from that shop. That was honesty. Honesty meant this guy could trust me, he didn't have to worry about me. When all the money was open right in front of me, and I could take as much as I want, he didn't care at all. He knew I would never take it. It's wonderful when people trust each other like that. I was so happy that this manager, who I'd known for many years, would leave me with all the money from his day's work, knowing it was safe. Sometimes he'd actually told me, sort of, you know, he's been round the back, "Brahm, can you just stay in the front here to make sure that no one steals anything?" he's done that to me, because he knows that even I'm a customer, I'm so trustworthy. In real life, that's what compassion and honesty does. It makes you a valued customer, gets you discounts, gets you a friend in all walks of life. So, it's not just living in a monastery, I live in the world sometimes. "Venerable Sir, when one has cancer, is it present or past karma? Kindly elaborate." It's both. Sometimes it is past karma, but sometimes it's present karma. You're always making karma. And sometimes most cancers are caused by stress.
You're working too hard, you're worrying, you don't know how to relax. So people find it so hard to relax these days. As soon as they get a holiday, what do? They go trekking in Nepal and wear themselves out. They go over to the United States, they go to Disneyland, they go here, they go there. My goodness, they get so tired they can't wait to get back to have a rest. And they pay money for that. Many of you have got a nice apartment, a nice house. Why don't you rest in that house? You know, many people in Australia come to Penang for their holidays. You're already here. Why don't you stay here and enjoy it? Why is it we don't know how to relax? We always think we've got to do something all the time. Now, in meditation, you learn how to relax. Really relax. Relax in a big way. And this is why that many Buddhists heal their cancers through meditation. You just go away because you relax and take away the cause, the stress. You know that I heard, I haven't checked this out, that in some parts of the capital of Delhi in India, when they have red traffic lights, they don't call them stop lights. When the light turns to red, you don't see the words STOP. You see the letters RELAX. They're relaxed lights. So when you come to the traffic junction and and it's red, it's relaxed time. We should have that in Penang. As soon as the red traffic light, this would be a big sign, relax, 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 you can't go anywhere, enjoy the moment. Because you call them not stop lights, relax lights. Then people wouldn't get cancers. How does one use the Dharma to help a drug addict who does not want to reform? As a family member, can accumulations of merits be shared with the addict to help them overcome this problem? Yeah, they can be shared. It needs a lot of kindness. Obviously, the most important thing, if you have a drug addict as in your family, empathy questions. Now the most important time. They are the most important thing, person to you when you're with them. And the most important thing to do is to care. Don't think what you're going to do. Don't think what you're going to say. Don't plan it all out. Don't have some idea of what your strategy should be. Go up to them and listen. Where is their problem? Why are people taking drugs? If you really give them importance, like that lady did in that story, the drug addicts wanted to get off that drug. They wanted help, understanding, a bit of love, an openness to find out how they were feeling. And then they came off. Why do people do that? I don't know. That's when if I see a drug addict, I listen to them and find out. That's what you should do. Try the Emperor's three questions. Or rather the answers to those three questions. When they're with you, make sure that in your heart, they are the most important person. You love them for who they are. You love them as a drug addict. You're not trying to change them. You're not hating them. You're listening to them, finding out who they are and why they are. Venerable Sir, what is the difference between Anapanasati and Satipatthana meditation? Can one attain Nirvana by practicing either one? I said that during the morning talks here. The Buddha said in Majjhima Nikaya 118, by fulfilling Anapanasati, you also fulfill Satipatthana. So they are the same. That's the Buddha's words, not Ajahn Brahm's. Both lead to enlightenment. That's the Buddha's words. There's no difference between Satipatthana and Anapanasati. If you do one, you do the other. So said the Buddha, Majjhima Nikaya number 118, paragraph 15, because I looked through it a couple of days ago. Venerable Ajahn Brahm, in this society where irresponsible dog owners tend to abandon their dogs on the street, causing much suffering to the animals, is it right for me to inform the council, which will shoot all dogs on sight? The SPCA will also put down the animals due to space constraints. I do not know if I am doing the right thing. Kindly advise. I didn't know that the council actually shoot dogs on sight. Is that true? My goodness, that's not so good. And maybe it's good for some Buddhist organization to, you know, try and make a sort of like a home for dogs who are on the streets, to actually to give them a place where they can stay and look after them. And maybe when they're at that home, actually to too new to them, so they don't get puppies, so they can't sort of have more dogs. And to have the council, instead of trying to solve the problem with bullets, to see if we can, I think they do this in many countries in the West now, to make sure that all dogs have a license and that most dogs are actually neutered by law, so they don't have puppies or they don't have kittens. Because, you know, too many dogs, too many cats, sort of are part of the problem in many cities of the world. And shooting them is just such a horrendous way of dealing with the problem. Surely we can have license all the dogs and cats and make sure that, you know, many of them are neutered, so they don't just breed, they're looked after and cared for. But in the meantime, maybe some Buddhist organization, compassionate organization, can actually start a little home for dogs. But that's just a suggestion. Could you enlighten us the reasons behind the practices that meditation retreats are usually conducted using the Samatha method instead of the Vipassana method of meditation? Some meditation retreats say they do one thing, some meditation retreats say they do the other thing, but all meditation retreats do the same thing. There is no difference between Samatha and Vipassana as taught by the Buddha. It's all the same practice. When you go up a mountain, you may go up the mountain for the peace. You may go up the mountain for the view. It doesn't matter why you go up the mountain, everyone who goes up the mountain will experience both the peace and the view. Someone may meditate for Samatha, for peace. Someone may meditate for Vipassana, the view. But it doesn't matter how you meditate, you all go up the same mountain. You experience peace and insight. There is no difference. Ajahn Chah kept on saying that. He said you cannot separate insight and calm no more than you can split the front and the back of the hand. Well, we would say the back and front of a coin. That's my teacher said that. That's my experience. That's what the Buddha said. Vipassana and Samatha go together as a pair. I'm in meditation practice. In meditation practice, how do we measure our advancement and progress under both meditation methods of Samatha and Vipassana? How do we know where we stand against both practices? What are the best practices? Okay, the best practice is not to do Samatha. The best practice is not to do Vipassana. The best practice is not to do Anapanasati. The best practice is not to do Eightfold Path. The best practice is to do peace. Do peace meditation. Make peace with yourself. Make peace with your mind. Make peace with this moment. Make peace with all the Samatha practices and all those who practice them. Make peace with all the Vipassana practices and all those who practice them. Make peace with the Christians, with the Muslims. Make peace with your wife. Make peace with your children. Make peace with your husband. That's how we practice meditation. We make peace instead of making war. Sometimes it's a Samatha are waging war with Vipassana. And Vipassana is waging war with the Samatha. And there's this great fight going on. And who's going to win the battle? Who's right? Who's wrong? If you fight a battle, you're both wrong. There was these two nuns who were arguing in this monastery in Thailand. And the abbot couldn't understand, find out who was right and who was wrong. And another monk came and said, and he was asked, what do you think? And he said, if they're arguing, they're both wrong. And the monk said, oh yeah, that's wise. If you argue, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong, you're both wrong. So stop all this arguing. Who's right and who's wrong? Instead of make peace, instead. One of our monks once was in a railway carriage in England, going to a talk. Someone got in the ticket, he went on the carriage, and someone was going to meet him at the station. When he got on the train, sitting down, minding his own business, this man came up to him, he was an evangelical Christian. He saw a Buddhist monk There's a sure path to heaven if you converted him. So I went up to him and told him the sweet news of baby Jesus. Started trying to convert him, haranguing him, rah, 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 rah. And this monk couldn't get a word in edgewise. And in the end, he said, "Look, my station's coming up. If you don't mind me saying this, I love you." Isn't that what Jesus said? That's what I say, and Buddha says as well. And he gave him a big hug and got out from the station. He won the argument. Can you do that? Now that was brilliant. What he's actually saying is going to the heart of Christianity, the heart of Buddhism. Make peace, compassion. The Buddha was the most compassionate person in the world. Saying, "The door of my heart's open to you, Christian, no matter what you say about me." Whatever it is, that's how we meditate. With compassion, kindness. I've been teaching that for the last 9 days to the people in this retreat. It's not a samatha retreat, it was a compassion retreat, wasn't it? I was kind to you, and I told you to be kind to yourself. You could take a rest at any time, that was compassion. When you came to the interviews, put your hands up if I scolded any one of you during interviews. Be honest. I never scolded one of you. I practiced compassion. I let you go to bed at any time. And many of you got the best meditation you've ever had. Compassion, kindness. The door of my heart's open to my mind right now. That's where it gets still. That's where it gets peaceful. That's where you get both calm and insight. Letting go, liberation, love, in German, Liebe, freedom, liberality, that's right, giving, all come from the same root. It may even come from the same root as live, to live. To live is to be free, to love is to live. To live is to be liberal, to give, to be free. All coming from the same word. This is what we mean by calm. This is what we mean by insight. Okay, some are not going to be able to have their questions answered. But in your next life, you may have your questions answered. My heart feels very tense. What should be a skillful way to deal with this? It's difficult to say open the door of my heart when it's so tense. Just wrench the door of your heart open. No, you can't wrench it down. If your heart is tense, then say, "I'll be content to be tense." I don't think I've told you the story. This is a man who went to the doctor once, and he told the doctor, a psychiatrist, "I've got this strange problem. Sometimes I think of myself as a marquee." You know a marquee, which they have down there, for the retreatants? A marquee. He said, "Sometimes I think I'm a marquee. At other times I think I'm a teepee." And the doctor thought, "That's really weird." And he said, "Ah, I know your problem. You're too tense." Come on, think about it. A marquee is a tent. A teepee is the tent which the Indians use. Sometimes I think I'm a marquee, sometimes I think I'm a teepee. Your problem is you're too tense. Okay, so if your heart is tense, yeah, it's a canvas thing which they use to keep off the rain and stuff like that. Anyway, if you are too tense inside, it means that to be able to relax, if you want that tension to disappear, you have to accept it. Be at peace with it. If you can't say the door of my heart's open to me, remember the story of the emperor who came into the demon who came into the emperor's palace. "Welcome, thank you for coming to visit me," the story I told last night. That's the way to get rid of anger-eating demons like tension in your heart. Don't give it anger, give it acceptance. "Thank you for coming to visit me, tension. It's so wonderful you come and teach me. So in acceptance, in letting go, treating it like an anger-eating demon, don't give it anger, then you'll find it gets smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less of a problem. That's how you work with tension. Good evening, Ajahn. If we test a monk who claims himself to be enlightened, will we create bad karma for ourselves? Thank you, and sadhu. Thank you for compassion meditation. See? Someone recognized that I do compassion meditation. It really depends on your intention. If you try and make a monk angry, just because you want to find out whether he's enlightened or not. Because I said the other day, that's usually the test the other monks do. We monks do. Someone says they're enlightened. We try and make them angry. Who, you? Ah, oh, come off it. Don't make me laugh. You will never get enlightened. Not someone like you. But we do it much more than that. Really try and make them upset. But sometimes if you want to try and do that, maybe if you try and do it with your friend, they say they're enlightened, you try and make them angry. If they are enlightened, then you'll be okay. But if they aren't enlightened, you're asking for trouble. So it's best to leave it to the monks to do the testing. Could Ajahn please explain the danger of I, ego, how to get rid of it? Well, that's a big one, the I, the ego. The I owns things, possesses things. That's what the I does. It's the ego. I am the one who owns, possesses. And what you possess, you tend to control. If you think you own your wife, you tend to possess and control her. And that's where your whole married life goes wrong. If you think you own your children, you try and control and possess them, and then they get so uptight that the first opportunity they leave home. Remember that these things you think are yours define who you think you are. You are defined by your possessions. So, what do you own? When you look at that, you find out who you are. That's enough on that one. I'm going to go for another 10 minutes. Oh, it's only 20 to 7, so it's quite early. Clock stop. No, it's 20 past 10, so go for another 10 minutes. Recently there is a Thai true story about a blind girl who went to an eye transplant, and after a successful transplant she could see a ghost and able to sense near future things happening in advance. This is because the previous eye donor used to see such things. Therefore, this problem happens to her again. Have you ever heard such cases before? It's interesting. I've never heard that story about a blind girl who had an eye transplant. Because the previous owner could see ghosts, and so could she. I have heard stories of people with heart transplants who actually got some characteristics of the ex-owner of the heart, but only for a week or two. There's one interesting story about a young girl who had a heart transplant, and after the transplant she kept on having nightmares about being murdered. When the mother went to see the doctor said, well look, it's very traumatic, it's a big operation having a heart transplant, she's probably just reacting to the drugs or to the trauma of the operation. But it kept on occurring, the mother didn't believe this doctor. She started doing her own investigation. She managed to find out where that heart came from, and she was surprised to find out that the heart came from a girl who'd been murdered. And her daughter had, in her dreams, dreamt of someone being murdered. So the mother went to see the police. And what she said of her girl's dreams was so close to what happened to the previous owner of the heart, the police went to interview that girl and got all the details of the dream which she had. And from that dream, the police got a picture of the murderer of that girl, went to that person, and he confessed. That was how they caught that murderer. Fascinating story. Someone was murdered, and the heart went to another person, and that person could tell the last days of that heart. But after a while, the memories disappeared, after a couple of weeks. Another man, his wife had a heart transplant. Before, she was a very, you might even say, a frigid woman. No, she was very proper, very restrained. But after a heart transplant, she became what you might call frisky. She was very, very kind, very, very loving and warm and sensuous. And so the husband wanted to find out who owned this previous heart. He found that it used to belong to a prostitute who was killed. Now his wife had a heart of a prostitute and acted accordingly. The book said he wasn't at all upset. But it only lasted for a short while. This is what the book was saying, that sometimes there's almost some sort of memory of the previous person, some almost like imprint, but that disappears after a short while. And you just assume the personality, you forget everything of the, or the past owner of that heart, all the memories disappear. Dear Bhante, what is the Buddhist point of view, karma or natural occurrence, regarding the earthquake in Iran which killed about 40,000 lives? Was that recently? I haven't seen the newspaper for a while. It's, sometimes there is some karma there, I don't know, sometimes it's just what happens, that when you're born and when you live in such areas, there is the chance that sometimes there's earthquakes, there's tragedies. Some of these things are accidental, not karma at all, but some of them are karmic. Why are those 40,000 people? So sometimes we, as I said with the Twin Towers, sometimes we do karma together. And sometimes we reap the fruits of that together. Sometimes people give donations together as a group and they make a collection. And sometimes people in syndicates win lotteries together. So sometimes it is group karma. Dear Ajahn, is meditation the only way to enlightenment? Thank you. The only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. And meditation is one part of the Eightfold Path. So, the only way to enlightenment is Eightfold Paths. Some Buddhists listen to Dharma talks and perform dana, etc., but in their daily lives their behavior and doing are totally non-Buddhist, like they're full of anger and ill will. How can it be so contradicting? Are they aware that they should practice the Buddhist way? Thank you. Yes, I know about this. People are Buddhists when in the temple, but as soon as they go outside that gate, they're angry at the traffic, they don't let anybody in when they're trying to sort of turn left or turn right. And sometimes when we're in the monastery, we are so saintly in front of the monk. But as soon as the monk goes out of the room, I'll tell this story. In one of the Buddhist stories, there was a teacher, an ancient teacher, had many disciples. He also had a daughter who was a very, very beautiful girl. It was a tradition in those days that the teacher would marry his daughter to one of the students. All of the students liked that girl. She was so charming, so beautiful, so lovely. And they all were competing for her hand in marriage. So they're very excited one day when the teacher called all the students together and said, "It's about time my daughter was married. I should marry her to one of you. I can't decide which one. And I also have another problem. So, in order to find out which one of you will marry my beautiful daughter, I'm going to set you a test. I want each one of you to follow these instructions. I want it to be a test of obedience and also a test of skill. Because I want you to creep into the local villages at night time. And I want you to steal whatever you can take while no one's watching. Because I'm very poor. That way you'll all steal a lot of goods. Whoever steals the most and is the most obedient will marry my daughter, and all the goods will be their dowry to give them a start in life." The students were really taken aback. They always thought of their teacher as moral and upstanding, and now their teacher was telling them to steal. But the obedience to their teacher was very strong, and also they all wanted to be the one to marry the daughter. So they crept into the village at night time, each one of them. They crept into the houses. When somebody was watching, they wouldn't steal anything. But when somebody wasn't watching, they'd steal this and steal that. And they'd take it back to their teacher. And the teacher would always ask them, from what house did you steal that? He'd keep a very careful record of who stole what, when, and from where. At the end of 2 weeks, the teacher brought all the students together again and said, you've stolen enough by now. The test is over. There's enough here to make any young married couple happy for many years. You've all stolen a lot, except one of you. And he looked at this young student who put his head down in shame. Why didn't you steal anything? Why didn't you follow instructions? And the young man said, but sir, I did follow your instructions. What do you mean? He said, I went into the village. I crept into the houses. I was about to steal something, but you told me not to steal anything if someone was watching. Yes, said the teacher, but didn't you wait for the people to go out? Yes, I waited for the people to go out, but there was still someone watching. Who, said the teacher? Me, said the student. I was always watching. That's why I couldn't follow your instructions. I did follow your instructions. That's why I couldn't steal. Whenever I was about to pick up something, I was watching me steal. Ah, said the teacher. Thank goodness I have one intelligent student amongst all you nincompoops. Oh, you other stupid students. This was a test of your wisdom and obedience. I told the villagers weeks before that this was going to happen. It's a setup. Take all those goods back. Here's a record of where they come from. The villagers will not harm you or hurt you, because they all knew it was a test. I'm rich enough as it is. I wanted to find out which one of you was worthy of marrying my daughter. And of course he married his daughter to the wise student, the one who couldn't steal because when he was about to pick up something, there was always someone watching. He was. So when you go out that door, there's always someone watching. If you shout at somebody, there's always someone watching. If you use bad language, someone is watching. You are. So that's why we don't do anything, bad or wrong. It doesn't matter if a monk is around or not around, if you're in a temple or not in a temple. So, Buddhists who do that aren't real practicing Buddhists. They're missing the boat. The reason why we don't practice anger and ill will is it makes us happy to be at peace, to be kind. Those of you in this retreat have practiced kindness and softness, compassion for all these 9 days. Did it work? Is it worth doing? If it's worth doing, carry on doing it. If you tell a person, don't be angry, don't have ill will, don't say rotten things to your wife, but you don't explain why, that's why they get angry, that's why they do bad things, because they still haven't understood why. You keep precepts because it gives you more freedom, more happiness. You are happier keeping those rules. If you keep 5 precepts, you're a happy little Buddhist. If you keep 8 precepts, you're even more joyful. If you keep 227 precepts, you're in ecstasy, like the 2 monks in front of you. There's an old story in the Japanese tradition. This man came up to this monk and bowed. He bowed so reverently. And he said, the monk said, why are you bowing to me? He said, oh, because you're a monk. Because you've given up so much. You live such a hard life. And so the monk got down on his knees and bowed to the man. What are you doing about that? Because you've given up so much happiness by living in the lay world. You're enduring so much not being a monk. That's why I'm bowing to you. If you bow to a person because they're having a hard time, then I should be bowing to you. People say, oh, it's so difficult to being a monk. No, it's so difficult being a layman or a laywoman. This is the easy way. I should be bowing to you. Understand? Yeah. So be good Buddhists. Otherwise, it gives me a bad reputation. If you come to my retreat, and you go home and you're so nasty to the people you live with, What's that going to say about Ajahn Brahm? You've been 9 days learning Ajahn Brahm's teaching. Is that what you've learnt? Ooh. Some people call it, oh, that's fine, I've done that one. Oh, that's the last question. I got through it. The last question of this retreat. See what this last question is. In today's paper, there was a couple and their 8-month son committed suicide by inhaling gas. What are the consequences of this action? Were they reborn in a woeful state and never have the opportunity in future existences to be reborn as a human? How about the baby who is too young to understand what decision his parents made? Can their family members do more meritorious deeds and transfer those merits to them so they have the opportunity to have a good rebirth? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for your advice. It's really sad what some people do like that. I'm not quite sure what the story was. Why a couple and an 8-month-old son, you know, committed suicide like that? Sometimes it is because of depression, sometimes it's because of anxiety, the pressures of life. And that's why if they'd have only come on this retreat, they'd have learned how to deal with the pressures of life, to be able to let go of their burdens, to be peaceful, make peace. Suicide and depression is a huge problem in our modern world. As we do more, as the stress increases, as we become more competitive to live such a lifestyle as we do, it means we have to learn how to relax more efficiently. And this is what you learn in Buddhism, how to let go, how to be at peace, how to relax. And if you could do that, then you would never feel so upset that you want to kill yourself or anybody else. It's a sign of great pain when the people do such things. If they do such things out of great pain, depression, they never get rid of the pain. All they get rid of is their body. And the pain is with them after death. Suicide is no option to deal with the problems of life. All you do is get rid of the body. The problems remain with you after death. So when a person does that, they usually linger around for a long time, still with their problems, adding to their problems with the guilt of what they've done. So the consequence of their action is usually be reborn as hungry ghosts. So what a person should do, what the monks should do, what anyone can do, is really give them lots of loving kindness, and especially forgiveness. To tell that person you made a mistake, a big mistake, but it's only a mistake. There's many other things you've done in life. There's an old story in psychology. 2 children going out to the supermarket. One drops a bottle of milk and it smashes on the floor. The other one drops a jar of honey. That too smashes on the floor. The one who dropped the milk, his mother says, "What a stupid child." The other one says, who dropped the honey, "That's a stupid thing you've done." There's a great deal of difference to the child who's called "you stupid child" and the one who's taught "that's a stupid thing you've done." One says the whole child is stupid. The other one realized it was a stupid act. The people who killed themselves, that was a stupid act. They're not stupid people. It was an evil act, but they're not evil people. It was a mistake, but they should not be judging their whole life by 1 or 2 mistakes they make. Too often do we call a person a criminal because of 1 act they've done in their life, and we neglect all the other acts they did that day, all the other acts they did that year, their lifetime. 1 stupid mistake and we call them a criminal. That is unfair. When I was teaching in jail, I said, "You are not criminals. You've done a criminal act." When you call a person a criminal, they become a criminal. That's why they re-offend. That's why they always go back again. If you say you've done a criminal act, it means you're much more than that criminal act. You're a person who's done something criminal. You're not a criminal. So I tell a person who's committed suicide, "You've done a silly act, but you're not a stupid person." So you do that to give the people who have died a perspective. People who have died like that, hungry ghosts, they can hear what's being said, especially if it's being said by monks. So if you say these things, you're actually almost giving them a sermon to try and ease their pain, to try and relieve them of their suffering. And when you relieve them of their suffering and they remember the good deeds they have done in their life, not just that silly act at the end, or the other pain which led to that act, then you release them from that terrible realm of being a hungry ghost. As for the son who was killed, again, those people thought they were doing something appropriate, but they did kill. It's bad karma doing that. As for that boy, we'll just probably go and seek another rebirth pretty quickly. 8 months old, he'd had a good karma to be reborn. He'll probably go and seek another birth in another family pretty soon. Not real worried for their son, but worried for those couple who committed suicide and killed their son at the same time. Suicide is a huge problem in the Western world. And the reason why we have suicide is because we forgot to be loving and caring, to forgive ourselves our faults. And if we're not caring, our faults become so huge, our pain becomes so immense, we can't stand it any longer. And instead of actually killing the ignorance, the stupidity of wrong seeing, we kill ourselves. So, if I go any longer, I'll be killing myself as well. So, not wishing to make bad karma, I will end the series of talks here. So, I hope you've got something out of these talks. If you have, you won't be like that person said in the question, when you go outside of this door, you'll be well behaved. Whether you're Buddhists or Christians, I don't care. As long as you're well behaved, kind to each other, forgiving, gentle in body, speech and mind. So let's share the merits of the 9 days. This is big sharing. All the merits of good karma, of listening to the Dharma, talking to the Dharma, looking after this retreat, meditating. Let's share it with all beings, including this couple and their child who committed suicide. Idam men yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinang ho tu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.